Sea throughout the solar system and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I'm here because you have a right to know and because you matter. This is Friday on this side of the planet. Now, I realize on the other side of the planet, it's Saturday. But where I'm seated, it's Friday. In fact, Friday evening. So it's weekend eve, and everyone is planning, I'm sure, all kinds of extracurricular things to do on the weekend. And got a little weekend of relaxation all lined up. Well, you know, I said, you matter. And I just want to remind you, although you probably don't need it, whatever it is you plan on doing, be safe out there. We don't want to lose anybody, all right? We publish a newsletter. It's called The K-Files. It's been around as long as this show has been around, shy of maybe a month, month and a half, something like that. A month or a month and a half after I started the show, we started publishing The K-Files. So it's been around for a long time. And you know, on May the 11th, we will celebrate the 13th anniversary of this show, meaning we start the 14th year of broadcasting at that point. And so K-Files has been here all that time. And a lot of you listening have been listening to the show for, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years and still haven't subscribed. Have you ever asked yourself, where's the genius in that? It's absolutely free, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. There are no strings attached. Just get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Click where it says K-Files. You can't miss that. It's great big letters right in the middle of your screen. Click that. You will get an automatic email, and it has a link in it that you have to click to activate your subscription. Now, once you do that, you're in, and you'll get the next edition of the K-Files. The next edition we publish twice a month, and the next edition comes out next Friday. How about that? So you'll be able to get that next edition if you subscribe now. As I said, it's absolutely free and no strings attached. My guest this evening is Richard Dolan. Now, Richard Dolan is well known to all of you who are part of what we loosely term the UFO community. You know all about Richard Dolan. And if you've been watching and listening here at the Kevin Smith Show for any length of time, you know he's been my guest several times here on the show. And I'm delighted that he's back with us again tonight. And we will begin talking with him right after this break that's coming up. But during this break, if you don't know Richard Dolan, look him up on the internet. I'll tell you a little bit about him when we come back, but look him up. It's really a privilege always when Richard Dolan is here. So we'll be back right after this break. All of the music used here at the Kevin Smith Show is from independent artists. Most of it from independent artists at musicalley.com. Go over to musicalley.com. Check out thousands of artists and thousands of great independent tunes. Musicalley.com. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest this evening is Richard Dolan. And let me, before I introduce him, just say, Richard, welcome back. We're glad to have you.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Folks, Richard Dolan is an American historian, and he studied at Alfred University and at Oxford. He was a candidate for a finalist, I think, for Rhodes Scholar. A master's degree from University of Rochester, where he studied U.S. Cold War strategy, European history, and international diplomacy. And he has been the foremost researcher and historian of the whole UFO phenomenon. I think, and I may be wrong, I know you had plans to release this book, and I'm betting it's released, Rethinking ET, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and that was planned for release early in 2013. Is it still yet to be released, or has it been?
It's about 1 to 2 months away, Kevin.
Okay. Well, we're still early in 2013.
Well, if I have it for the first half of 2013, I'm going to count that as early 2013.
Well, yeah. Oh, man. Well, Richard, can we talk a little bit about that concept of rethinking ET?
Yes, absolutely. The title of this book, by the way, has gone through a few permutations. So I think the main title is going to be UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. And I'll have another subtitle for that. I'm thinking of this book as really a new, fresh introduction to the entire field of UFOs, UFO research, ufology. I felt that this is a topic in need of a kind of a fresh rethinking. And that's what I've really tried to do. So it's a 300-plus page book that is, I think, a good introduction to someone who doesn't know a lot about this topic, but also, I think, a useful rethinking of the topic to those who may be more experienced in the field. So,
all right, yeah. Let's talk about the rethinking part and the 21st century mind part. Is the 21st century mind significantly different than the 20th century mind?
Well, the 21st century is significantly different than the 20th century, and I think therefore the 21st century mind is certainly evolving into something very different. Look at the changes that ufology has had to contend with over the last, let's say, 20 years.
Okay.
It's really what the world has had to deal with, but mm-hmm. ufology as well, the study of UFOs. We've had the internet. 20 years ago, we were at the very beginning stages of this thing that became the internet. In the early 1990s, there were a couple of bulletin board groups out there, and that was about it. There was no web. So what we have in this last generation is much greater communication. We also have much greater scientific knowledge than we had even 20 years ago. And I think there's been a sea change in a number of scientific fields, which we can discuss, but I think have also affected human consciousness and also ufology in general. We're also at a point in our world today in which, more than ever before, people are able essentially to create their own UFOs in any number of ways, whether through remotely operated little models that you can buy off the shelf in any grocery store, or you can create it using Adobe After Effects and other video editing software, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen a real sea change in how at least many people approach this topic, and really what I'm talking about is a rise in what I would call non-materialistic theories on UFOs. 20 years ago, it was still very much, I think, the dominant direction in which you'd have UFO researchers looking at this, as we say, the old cliche being the nuts and bolts variety of looking at the phenomenon, mm-hmm. basically as men and women or beings, physical beings from another world. And not that that has gone away, it certainly hasn't, that idea is still with us, but I think there's been a much greater emphasis among at least some people involved in this field in ways of understanding this phenomenon that are not physical, not materialistic, I'm not taking a position one way or the other on this. I think that there's interesting elements to both of those ideas. And also, I think, you know, lastly, in the last generation or so, there's been a greater, let's say, a greater noise-to-signal ratio in this field. And by that, I simply mean there's a lot, there are so many more reports today than there were 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's not even in the same ballpark. If you go online to hunt down contemporary UFO sighting reports, you go to the top two websites out there. There's the National UFO Reporting Center, and there's the MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, their database. If you combine those two databases, they're reporting over 10,000 UFO sightings every year in North America alone. It's an unbelievable,
an incredible, just in North America.
That's right. So now, that's not all legitimate UFOs. I'm not suggesting that. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is an important part of the problem. Because we have the web, because it's so easy now for people to issue a report, the problem is there's just no capability, really, to investigate more than a sliver of those. Mm-hmm. So what we have, and that's just with reports that are out there, then there's YouTube videos, there's hundreds of new ones every year. These almost never get investigated. And there's claims and more claims and more claims and more claims. So what we have is a tremendous amount of noise. And where do we find the signal within that noise?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a generation or two ago, that was still a problem, but I think it's a bigger problem today. So all of these things have affected what we would call ufology in the last 20 years. This is not the ufology of 1985. I mean, that's a dead era. It's never coming back.
This is not your grandma's ufology.
Indeed, it ain't. And we're in now 2013, and the world is not stopping in 2013. There's going to be a 2020. There's going to be a 2030. And one of the things that I feel is very important is for people to realize why UFOs continue to matter. And then there's a whole other aspect, which I also deal with in this book, which is the radicalization of really the entire world. And particularly, I think since 9/11, we can all see this having happened. You know, people might ask, well, in a world in which it looks like the government's going to strip your rights away, you know, spy on you through your computer, engage in, you know, whatever false flags people want to say are out there, how is it possible that this topic could even matter? I mean, we have other things to worry about. And on the face of it, that's a valid question too. But in fact, what I argue is that ufology is possibly the most radical of all the subjects that one could really get into. If you really deal seriously and in a sophisticated way with the topic of UFOs, you find it's a very radical topic.
I was about to ask you, so why do UFOs still matter? And you just answered that. So let's talk about it. You say it's a radical topic, and I fully recognize that when I talk with people out in public at gatherings, you know, that are not UFO gatherings, and the subject comes up, because they're curious, they know I do a talk show, and well, what do you talk about, you know? So when the subject comes up, the responses I get sometimes indicate that they certainly think it's radical, and they certainly, not everybody, but a lot of them, and they certainly have somewhat of a radical reaction to it. Why? Why is it radical?
Well, it's radical because we are in our officially sanctioned reality.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the reality that we're supposed to believe, that we're allowed to believe without fear of ridicule, the reality that's essentially handed down from the top of the human pyramid, that is our power structure. In that reality, UFOs are not supposed to exist. They're just not. The problem with that statement is that people see them every single day, and they're seeing things not simply, you know, innocuous lights in the sky that might be explainable in any number of ways. I mean, there are some of those sightings. But there are people who are having what I would call up-close and personal sightings of craft that are just not supposed to exist. And so when you deal with the implications of what that means, let me talk about these implications. All right.
Mm-hmm.
You see a triangle UFO, let's say, a perfect triangle directly above you. It's absolutely silent. It just seemed to appear out of almost nowhere, which some of them really do. And it's just motionless. And then from a motionless point of view, from a motionless position, rather, it just moves. Maybe not in a supersonic way, but absolutely silent, and it's gone. That's a radical thing.
Mm-hmm.
The implications of that are, who's making something that's that large? Some of these triangles are enormous. How can it be silent? How can it go from silent loitering and hovering to instant motion and gone? What's the energy source behind it? Who's making this thing? Where is the civilization? Is it a black budget thing that we're making? That's significant. If it is, mm-hmm. or is it something beyond our civilization, which many people have been claiming for many years, myself included? So right there, in one simple UFO sighting, you have very dramatic implications. But in fact, it goes even much more than that. I mean, one of the things that I think we've all come to realize with this topic of UFOs is how lame the phrase UFO actually is when we're really talking about the sum total of this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think what we're interested in is much more than simply unidentified flying objects. That is interesting. And that does, I think, signify a greater reality that we need to confront and try to understand. But actually what we're dealing with is a very multifaceted phenomenon. You know, there are a number of subsets of the UFO topic that you literally could spend your entire life just studying that one subset. You could start with the history of UFO sightings as a historian, you know, from ancient times to today. I mean, that alone is a multiple lifetimes worth of work. You could study the politics and the cover-up, which mm-hmm. I've spent a lot of my own time doing. That is, ask yourself, is this a phenomenon that has had interest by the United States military or other militaries or other governments? And has there been a cover-up? I mean, my goodness, you could spend your entire life studying that. You could similarly spend your entire life studying the phenomenon of abduction, or let us say alleged abduction and alleged contact. Certainly there have been people who have done exactly that and who are doing that. You know, it's not always a topic that people are comfortable dealing with. You know, talking about a sighting of an object in the sky is one thing, but saying that you or someone you know has had a possible encounter with a non-human being that did something to them, or that they claim to have channeled, or that they claim to have made, you know, all of these, this is out there stuff. The problem with it is that it's a phenomenon that will not go away. You could spend your entire lifetime actually thinking about how best to conduct proper investigations of UFOs in our own era. I've thought a lot about this for the new book. In other words, 50 years ago, the big problem that researchers had, one of the big problems, was actually just getting access to data, getting access to reports. It was not the easiest thing in the world. And then when you'd get a report, you'd have to go investigate it. But the problem number one was getting a report. Today, that's not our problem. Today, we have the opposite problem. We're in an era of instant information. We're also in an era of YouTube videos that are not always legit. We're in an era of Facebook, which is basically copy and paste journalism where rumors spread like wildfire, where, again, the problem is it is so necessary today to develop a kind of rational approach, I would say, to investigating UFOs. But that's another subset. Then there's a subset of UFOs in science, or UFOs in weird science, as I sometimes think of it. Another case in point. That triangle that I mentioned, you know, earlier. So one obvious question is, what is the method by which it can move from point A to point B?
Mm-hmm.
It's not making any noise. It seems to be using something a little bit better than petroleum. I think most of us assume that it is. Mm-hmm. What is that source of energy? That's important.
And, by the way, I have seen one of those. In fact, my whole family saw it. We stopped and watched it for a while. It just hovered over a field, and then when it took off, it really took off.
Was it, say, a triangle craft?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah, 1991 or 92. Right. And when it took off, it took off. And I mean, no sound. And it came right over us. And it was no more than maybe at that point, 1,000 feet above us. And it was big. It was big.
Right. So the question is, what is the source of energy of these things? How do they do what they do? What's the method? Do they use what we call electrogravitics, which I think is a reasonable speculation? If so, what is the source of energy that powers their electrogravitic reactions? All of these are important scientific questions, but it gets even weirder than that, frankly, when we deal with science. After all, UFOs certainly bump into issues connected to, say, space-time and contemporary cosmology, because inevitably we ask the questions, well, if they are not from our civilization, if that's a possibility, we do need to ask how they got here from wherever they happen to be. Did they come from another part of the galaxy? Did they come from beyond the galaxy? Did they come from some other dimension of reality? All of these questions, they're fair questions to ask, and it turns out that contemporary physics is now finally giving us a kind of a language and conceptual tools that will enable us to ask these questions a little more intelligently. So this is something else that I feel is important. And then finally, with weird science, it's simply the whole issue of UFOs, and let us just go right there and say it, consciousness, one of these buzzwords of the last generation that sometimes I think gets overused, but I do feel is an important aspect of the UFO phenomenon. Time and again, you find in witness accounts, people state that they had a kind of telepathic connection with either the beings and the objects or the beings themselves. What does that mean? What does it mean in which in a being apparently can abduct or take someone and manage their memory and create false memories? There's an important element of the human mind that's involved in this. And then it goes even further than that.
We'll continue in just a moment. We have to step away for a break. And we'll continue talking with Richard Dolan after this break. And I want to get into the consciousness thing a little bit. In fact, quite a bit. It is kind of a buzzword. It has become a cliche almost. But I think it's very important. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this.
Play some cards. You lost my my money, you lost my car. Had to foot your way back to LA. You only made it half of the way. I said, feel sorry, but I really don't. You think I'll come get you, but this time I won't.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Richard Dolan, and we're discussing UFOs, and at the moment we're talking about rethinking our approach to this whole thing. And as we went away for break, you just begun to mention consciousness, and you said you hated to kind of use that because it has become sort of a buzzword, but it has, and almost these days a cliche. But the fact is, there is no escaping the connection of consciousness with those things, because either somebody out there's their consciousness created it and brought it here, or some secret military stuff, their consciousness was involved in creating it and flying it. Or if it's just our mass hallucination, our consciousness is creating it in our minds. And then there are many, many other types of, I would say, more serious avenues by which consciousness is connected. But there's no escaping that consciousness is involved here.
Right. Right, and I think you're accurately distinguishing between some of the different ways that we can talk about this sometimes vague, sometimes very specific thing called consciousness. What my question would be, just to kind of ease into this, would be: do people have the ability, by the power of the mind, to communicate with beings from elsewhere? To me, this is really where the rubber meets the road in the whole consciousness issue. I mean, yes, we can back up and say accurately that, you know, your thoughts really do create your reality in your mind. I mean, look, at any given moment, you and I and everyone listening are bombarded with literally millions of data bits every moment or every second, I guess. And we can't process them all. So we have to make decisions, and that very process of weeding out the stuff that we don't think we need, we're essentially creating our reality. I'm not talking about that. That's fascinating, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm asking, which is what many people believe, do we have the ability, by the power of our minds, to communicate with beings from elsewhere? That is, through a telepathic or mental connection. And there are many people who adamantly say the answer to that is yes. And there are a number of people who say that's nonsense, poppycock, whatever. And you know, I think the reason we have to deal with this question, because it just won't go away. I entered this field about two decades ago now. I mean, I wasn't known for about 5 years of researching it, but when I got into this field, I was not really thinking about consciousness really in any significant way. I was Mr. Nuts and Bolts in my own research. That's still really my predilection, is to do that. But the thing is, there are claims that will not go away, that such and such thing has happened. And I can only recount how many times have I heard this type of anecdote. Someone says, I was sleeping in my room. It was 2-3 in the morning. And suddenly I woke up and I had an urge to look out my bedroom window. And when I did, I saw an orange glowing orb of light in my yard. I've heard people explicitly say this to me a couple of times. And I've read a few accounts like this. So the question is, what is that all about? What is it, apparently, that can allow these other intelligences, whatever they are, to get into our heads? And is it also possible, as some people claim, that the very act of meditation, if they meditate, if they act in a certain way, they will claim that they have either more UFO sightings or that they have an experience of some sort that they believe is extraterrestrial connected to their meditation. These are not scientific protocols that have been followed here, I will grant you that. But there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence or anecdotal claims to this effect, and I do find it interesting. So the question is, and you know, also, let me just mention the latest movie by Dr. Stephen Greer has just come out called Sirius. I saw it yesterday. And without making a comment on the movie one way or the other, but this is, you know, and he and the people who follow him obviously claim adamantly that through their own particular style of meditation and attempts to make contact with these extraterrestrials, that they're doing this as well.
Well, let me comment on that.
Go right back to the 19th century theosophical movement of Helena Blavatsky and probably even before that.
All right, let me throw a comment in on this not being according to scientific protocol. Most of what we do in life is not according to scientific protocol. My grandmother used to make fantastic, out of this world homemade biscuits. And my entire life, she's gone now, but my entire life, I never saw her use measuring spoons. I never saw her use a measuring cup. It was a pinch of this, half a handful of that, and, you know, but the results were biscuits. Okay? The point is, without scientific protocol, there was, you still had results. You still had the product. And so a lot of this stuff that I'm very skeptical about it. I really am. I'm open-minded about it, but I'm an open-minded skeptic, you know. But a lot of it produces phenomenal results. And there is an account of this happening with I think he's... I'm not sure what his rank was, but he was Navy. And this was in a military setting, and he was reporting that there was such a telepathic contact. And so I think there was a general that was talking with him and said something like, oh, yeah, well, why don't you just telepathically tell him I want to see a UFO? And he said, okay, and he did. And he said, gentlemen, if you'll just look out that window. And there was a UFO out there.
Yeah, that's I know that story. And that took place in the late 1950s, I think 1959. And it took place at CIA headquarters in Washington, in Langley, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Navy officer, I think he was an officer, who had gone up to Maine to check out a woman named Frances Swan, S-W-A-N. She was a neighbor of a retired Navy admiral who knew about her work, and he was absolutely convinced that she was for real. So this Navy admiral named Knowles contacted his people and said, you got to send someone out to look at this woman because she's channeling an extraterrestrial entity. And so the Navy, U.S. Navy actually sent a couple of guys up there. Eventually, she ends up training one of them on how to do this. And he has what he believes is contact.
Mm-hmm.
This is all a true story. So he goes back down to Langley, and he's connected with CIA and the National Photographic Interpretation Center, NPIC. The leader of NPIC is a brilliant man at the time named Art Lundahl, who on a number of occasions briefed John F. Kennedy. In fact, he briefed Kennedy on the Cuban Missile Crisis situation. Lundahl was a big cheese at CIA, and Lundahl is at these meetings. So the Navy guy, who was, I think his name was Neesham, there were, the story is a little bit unclear to me. I think he did this twice, and on the one occasion, he sat down, and the being, who's called AFFA, A-F-F-A, did appear out the window according to some, not all, of the people present. All of mm-hmm. these stories are, you know, they never give you everything in a story. You know, every time you think you got a good UFO story, when you look into it, something is taken away. So, but there were people present in the room who looked out the window and said that they saw a craft that was there.
Yeah, but now let me throw this in.
Yeah.
The fact that something is taken away or something seems to be missing, in my opinion, makes it more realistic and more likely to be true based on my years as a professional police investigator. You can have 20 people that watch a crime. Every one of them tells you exactly what happened, except every one of them will leave a piece of it out that one of the others will tell you.
Sure, that's quite reasonable, Kevin. And mm-hmm. I'm not trying to impugn this story. I think it could very well have happened just the way it was claimed to have happened. But anyway, that's some of the background of that fascinating mm-hmm. story, which I'm glad you mentioned.
Well, and that's that consciousness connection. It may right. not be according to scientific protocol, but there were biscuits.
Yeah, I bet I would have enjoyed your grandmother's biscuits, by the way.
Well, I guarantee you would.
It sounded very nice.
But, I mean, there was results and witnessed by others. And so, you know, one of the things, though, by the way, I've noticed this a little more often now in the 21st century. There's a polarization happening in so many fields. And so the right is becoming more right and the left becoming more left, not just in politics, but in lots and lots of fields. And this is happening in science in that, you know, there are the traditional establishment-oriented scientists that are just defending the status quo, and they're becoming more that way. But there are some who are breaking out of that and becoming more outspoken, going the other direction for kind of free thinking. And I've been seeing in documentaries, I watch a lot of documentaries about a lot of different things, and almost never watch anything but documentaries. And I'm seeing some scientists now, even some NASA scientists, that will say, well, we've observed this, and they're talking about something astronomical, you know, not UFOs, they don't talk about that, but... we've observed this. It does this. We don't know why it does that. And, you know, they'll just come out and say, we don't know, but it's doing it. And that doesn't fit with our known theories of how this thing is supposed to work. So,
well, right. I mean, what we're getting to is a point in our science where we're really understanding that we don't understand.
Yeah.
That there, mm-hmm. scientists, physicists do not have a grand unified theory of everything, first of all. Mm-hmm. So there's holes. And there are things that happen in our reality that truly are anomalistic and that seem to be connected in some way or another with this whole idea of consciousness. For the last couple of centuries, there has been this, probably the most famous experiment in physics is called the double slit experiment. It actually was first done almost 200 years ago, I think. And it's been refined ever since. And it might be useful just for me to explain this a little bit, because this is kind of a window into just how weird our world is and why this affects the study of UFOs. But the idea is, like, when you shoot electrons at a barrier, the barrier's got a little slit, it's got one vertical slit, okay? And then behind that is another wall. So if you did that one at a time, you'd get a spray pattern where the electrons hit the wall, but with a definite vertical column where most of the electrons hit.
All right, we'll have to get the rest of that when we come back. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Richard Dolan. Richard, as we went away for break, you were starting to talk about the double split experiment.
Yeah, the double slit experiment. You know, here we are in a show about UFOs, but hey, let's go there, because actually it's really quite fascinating, and I think the implications of this will help get our heads in the right place here when we get it to the next topic beyond this. But basically, it goes like this. So you've got, visualize a wall with a vertical slit and then a wall behind it. So you shoot electrons at the barrier. And what you get is a spray pattern where the electrons hit the wall, but you get like a vertical column where most of them hit. So they would behave just as particles would be expected to behave, okay? Now, when you create a second vertical slit for them to pass through, there's a pattern on the wall behind that shows a classical interference pattern that indicate that the electrons behave not like particles, but like a wave. So the photons, light particles, travel as waves, but they're still getting detected as particles on this wall. Now, this even happens when you fire one electron at a time. So one electron at a time through the single slit, you get a particle pattern. One electron at a time through the double slits, you still get a wave pattern. Doesn't make much sense, but that happens. It gets even stranger than this. This is even when you shoot one electron at a time through one slit and then one electron at a time through the other, still a wave pattern. Now, is it possible, people have asked this question, that the photons pass through both slits at once? Well, this is where it gets really weird, because when scientists try to detect which slit individual photons pass through with detection devices at each slit, so each photon is seen to go through either one slit or the other, but never both. Okay, that's fine. However, now they get a uniform distribution pattern with no interference. So these are photons behaving as particles. In other words, here's the bottom line. The act of observation seems to have caused the photons to lose their wave nature and to act as ordinary particles. This is where, and it gets even weirder still. I'm glad I'm talking about this, because it was fresh in my mind. I've been kind of going over this a little bit. Because what they've confirmed experimentally, proof really, is that the thought of the observer determines the result of how the light behaves, even retroactively. There's a very great physicist named John Wheeler. He died recently. He proposed something called the delayed choice experiment, and has since been replicated and has been proven. So imagine a setup where you got two telescopes. They're positioned behind a detection screen. Each telescope is aimed precisely at one of the slits. So after the individual photon passes through one of the slits, the detection screen can be removed very quickly to reveal the telescope. And this allows the photon to pass through one of the telescopes. So the scientist can decide whether or not to remove the screen. If he wants to keep the screen up, then you end up with the standard interference pattern, photons acting like waves. But if the experimenter chooses to remove the screen, what he ends up with is an exact particle distribution, no interference patterns. It's as if the choice of the experimenter determines whether the photons act as waves or particles. But the thing is that the choice happens after the photons have gone through the slits. So I would just ask people to let their brains consider that for a moment. Maybe I haven't explained this very well. But in other words, the experimenter's choice in the present has somehow affected the behavior of the photon in the past. This isn't me making this up, okay? So I would say, if you wrap your brain around this and you just go, huh, this doesn't make sense, read up on this. This is, there's lots of websites out there that describe the double slit experiment. The bottom line is this. We have this very strange universe, and what these physicists, these are the top physicists in the world, what they believe is that your interaction with the experiment determines whether or not light acts as a wave or a particle. Sounds impossible, but there you have it. This is cutting edge physics.
Well, we've talked about, actually, we've talked about this a number of times with a number of different guests over the past 2 or 3 years. And, you know, I think that, you know, for those who question, is there such a thing as consciousness? And folks, believe it or not, out there in the world of psychology, there has been, over the years, a big debate as to whether there is actually something called the human mind, believe
exactly.
it or
it's
not.
They call it the brain wars. This mm-hmm. is a very big field in neuroscience. It's a huge, huge battle.
These experiments, I think, prove the existence of consciousness. There are also the experiments of Dr. Gerald Epling. And he's just one of the most amazing individuals I've ever interviewed. He's done lots of experiments with plants and even with eggs, and monitoring whether they have a response to certain things. Now, lots and lots of experiments have been done in the past, like if you play music to your plants, then they respond one way. If you don't play music, if you talk to them, if you don't talk to them, and the plants respond, and that's all been scientifically recorded. What he's been able to do is show they respond to your thoughts. Now, that doesn't mean a plant has consciousness, nor does it mean we do. But it does mean we're participating together in a consciousness that links us.
I like that thought. That's, I think, quite interesting and very much in line with what a number of, I would say, courageous neuroscientists are, in fact, suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation not long ago with one such neuroscientist, and I think that's his opinion. He's a PhD neuroscientist. His attitude is it's not necessarily that we have mind, but that we're tuning in, as it were, to a cosmic mind, and mm-hmm. that we somehow are kind of receivers for it. I think that's his conception.
And I think that's the case, because to the best of our knowledge, a plant does not have a brain. To the best of our knowledge, we do. Although I've never seen mine. And if you ever get to see your brain, you're in trouble. But to the best...
Watch out for someone named Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
In the vicinity.
But to the best of my knowledge, we all have brains, and the plant doesn't. So the brain cannot be the function area here. And there has to be something else happening if a plant can respond in a measurable scientific way, and it's recorded on instruments.
We're talking about something called non-locality is really, mm-hmm. I think, one of the fundamental things. In other words... is there a non-local or a non-physical part of us that exists outside beyond the thing we call our body?
Mm-hmm.
And can the mind exist in something other than the brains that we have in our head? And my own opinion, and I'm not a neuroscientist, so many would say, well, you're not qualified to have an opinion. I have my opinion. My opinion is that I think there is non-locality, and that the mind, to me, does seem to be able to exist outside the brain.
Dr. Epling's, let me give you this since you said that. His specialty, his PhD work, is in memory. He's a research scientist. And
this is the man who had a near-death experience?
No. This is the guy who did the experiments with the plants and the eggs and stuff. And he said on this show, he said, we know just about everything there is to know about memory, except where it's stored. He said, memory is definitely not stored in the brain. So where is it stored, you know? Maybe in your
brain. I've never heard that opinion expressed ever before. I mean, I'd always assume that it would be some kind of brain function there.
He equates the brain to the CPU of a computer, but the memory is on a hard drive somewhere. Where is it? The brain calls it up, but where is it being stored? And that's a great mystery. But how does this fit with UFOs? It fits this way, folks. lots and lots and lots and lots of people who have had some kind of contact with extraterrestrials talk about a telepathic communication.
Exactly.
And I don't think I have ever had such a thing happen to me, but I also am not a person who says, well, if it doesn't happen to me, it can't be real. You know, I've also never right. seen the Eiffel Tower, but it does exist. All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. We'll open up the telephone lines on the other side. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome. We're glad to have you. And let me extend to you my sincerest sympathy for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour. My sincerest hopes, dreams, wishes, and prayers that you never suffer that tragedy again. We are talking this evening with Richard Dolan, and we are going to open the telephone lines here in just a moment. But first, let me ask Richard, are you ready to take some telephone calls?
That's always fine, Kevin. Not a problem at all. If I can finish my last, one thing I want to say on this whole consciousness element that we're getting into, which is absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of my goals in at least in dealing with the science aspect of UFOs and the consciousness part of it, is not to say that every alleged channeler or person who claims to have a telepathic download of some ET message is telling the truth. I'm not saying that at all. I think many of these people are either delusional or sometimes even worse. Some may be legit, but here's the problem. It's twofold. The first thing that I want to do is to indicate that contemporary science does at least give us a way to at least begin to accept some of these claims, or at least to consider them as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this also goes with things like remote viewing, which is, you know, pretty much the same type of thing. So there's science that does seem to allow for this. So that's a good thing. That's interesting. But of course, the other side of it that I try to emphasize is that I think it's important that we try to explore consciousness and claims in a responsible way. And this does not give us license, therefore, to throw out scientific ways of testing, rules of evidence and all of this. I mean, there are people who really go, I think, so far into what I would say New Age philosophy that they essentially think of science as optional, or even worse, that they don't really need to abide by that. If something feels right to their heart chakra, let's just say, then it's good enough for them. But it's not good enough for me, and I don't think it should be good enough for responsible researchers. So I think consciousness does matter, but there must be a way moving forward into the 21st century for us to be able to understand consciousness in a way that's scientific and that's responsible.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Richard, I have a question.
Well,
you just started breaking up, Brent. I actually cannot hear you.
And Brent, say it again. Your audio broke up.
Touching on, but you haven't directly addressed it yet. In your new book,
I missed the very first part of what. Okay,
That's okay. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, go.
In your new book, how much time do you spend on healthy skepticism?
I think you're saying healthy skepticism. You're breaking up really bad, Brent. But I think that's what you said.
Yes, so, I like to spend a fair amount of time on healthy skepticism. In fact, I think my entire book is. I like to think it's informed by healthy skepticism. My very first chapter, which is essentially called What Are UFOs, is simply to remind people that historically and to this very day, that 90%+ of everything that people think that they see in the sky that may be a UFO is certainly not anything other than something prosaic. What we often think of as UFOs are either tricks of atmosphere, tricks of our eyes, and a whole number of other things that, you know, in our era today can easily be something other than what you know, they may at first glance appear. In fact, in this book I wrote about my own experience a number of years ago, right outside Roswell, New Mexico, in the early morning, 4 a.m., I was driving out of Roswell with my wife, Karen, and we got out of the car to look at the moon. It was very beautiful. And she saw what she thought was a moving object in the sky. And I looked at it too, and I thought, wow, I think it's just zipping around there, isn't it? Until I took my camera and put it on the roof of my car and looked through the camera, and I noticed this thing wasn't moving at all. And it was what we would call a scintillating star. You know, typical, you know, it's happened millions of times to other mm-hmm. people. But I guess rational skepticism, healthy skepticism is essential. And it's something that I feel is very important. We can't just believe something because you want to believe it. Obviously, we have to be based on, based what we believe on evidence if we're going to be responsible about it.
Or do what I do. Don't believe anything.
Well, right. I mean, belief itself, that's taking the ultimate Zen approach, Kevin, and I salute you for that.
Well, that doesn't mean I disbelieve. It just simply means I know or I don't know. And if I don't know, I just don't.
Yeah, the hardest thing to do, and this is very hard, I will have to say, for anyone who's a public or even semi-public figure, and I guess I count at this point, is that there's always a danger that you as a public person, because you become identified with a particular point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, whatever you are. You know, if you're Michael Shermer, a president of the Skeptic Society, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Do you really think that he never, ever has doubts in his own mind that maybe some of these UFOs are real? I'll bet you he does.
No, I don't think so. I think he's God, isn't he?
But the thing is, all of us are in danger, and I include myself here, of trapping ourselves into a kind of mental prison, because that's what we're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. You know, we've kind of created a reputation, and this is what you have to be. And I never ever want that to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. In the 13 years that I've now been publicly known in the UFO field, I have always been a, quote, believer in the reality of UFOs, I guess you could say that. But I have certainly tried, and I will continue to try to expand my own notions and challenge my own beliefs
mm-hmm.
as to what I think this is all about.
Well, regardless of what position you take, there are people that are going to make that into something else. You know, I have steadfastly for years since I started this show, steadfastly said, I don't believe, I either know or I don't know, and I'm comfortable with saying, well, I don't know, you know. But here's what I'm getting at. Because of the fact that I have said I don't believe in UFOs, I have had people post things on the internet, that I'm some sort of government agent. I'm a government, and I got to say, if I am, they are way behind on their checks.
Don't you think, Kevin, though, that when you say you don't believe in UFOs, you're being a little coy?
No, I don't believe in UFOs. I know they exist because I've seen them.
Ah, see, that's what I'm talking about.
I either know them, or I don't.
You do. Right.
And the problem is most people that use the language don't speak proper English. They don't understand English. To say I don't believe is not saying I disbelieve.
No, I get what you do. Mm-hmm. I get it, and I think most people listening get it too. But mm-hmm. I would say it's a little coy.
Well,
I'm not saying it's unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Saying it's, you know, we all do our thing with language. And,
yeah, well, I don't believe in doorknobs, do you?
What's that?
I don't believe in doorknobs, do you?
Touché, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, either these things exist or they don't. And if they do, they just do. And they do. I've seen them. And I know they exist, and I don't care if anybody believes that or not. I don't believe it. I know it, you know? 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. That's the number to call, and you have the opportunity to speak to one of the foremost historians in America, and specifically, I would say, the foremost historian when it comes to the topic of UFOs and DTs. As a historian, you have to do a whole bunch of research and sort through a whole bunch of stuff just to get a few grains of usable things. Have you, in all of your sorting through all those reams and reams and tons of stuff, ever had a wow moment where you found something that blew you away?
Yeah, a few times. a few times where I specifically found something that, other people had not encountered. Let's see. One time in the U.S. National Archives. I mean, this isn't really wow for most people. I caught a CIA reference to a particular UFO researcher as one of our guys.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's not really very well known today. Robert Todd, who was one of the early Freedom of Information Act requesters in the 1970s. And I remembered reading this thinking, holy hot damn, what does this mean? I remember it, not in doing document research, but speaking with a former researcher, William Steinman, who I think if there were MVP awards for UFO research in the 80s, he would have gotten a few. I chatted with him on one occasion, and he told me point blank that the former UFO researcher, William Moore, who's famous slash infamous, was explicitly working for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely believe that. Steinman gave me extremely clear reasons as to why he believed that was the case. One time in the Canadian National Archives, I found a document by the late Philip Klass, the foremost skeptic debunker of the time back, you know, circa 1980. And Klass had written this nasty, nasty letter to the Canadian government smearing researcher Stanton Friedman,
mm-hmm.
who was then moving to Canada.
Yeah.
And Klass, what he really was, he was doing was telling these Canadian scientists, officials who were at the time receiving UFO reports, and they didn't really want to, but they were charged with it. He said, be careful, because Friedman is going to accuse you of cosmic Watergate. And what he ended up doing is he frightened these timid little scientists so much that they were able to drop the UFO project. They actually, within a year or two, ceased accepting UFO reports from the Canadian public.
Yeah.
Which I think was Klass's goal all along. But in terms of like wow moments, I mean, most of the truly wow documents that I've come across were not ones that I found myself, but just that other researchers in years past have found. But yeah, I mean, there's a few. Mm-hmm. Everyone should know some of these. There's especially some of the...
Let me say to our caller, hang on, we'll get to you in a second. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, there's just a number of very amazing declassified documents from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s that are just extraordinary. I mean, just incredible. And we can get into them in a minute. But the thing is, these documents, people have to understand, have come down to us by accident, really historical accident. And that accident is called the Freedom of Information Act. And I say that because it could just as easily not have happened. And it was only for about a five-year window, by the way, that we were really able to get most of these UFO documents out through the Freedom of Information Act. Thank you, Jimmy Carter. It was really during that era that it happened, because that window really closed down during most of the Reagan years. But we got what we got, and they are fascinating, and they describe case after case of violations of sensitive airspace by objects, quite frankly, that were not supposed to exist, but boom, there they were. And we can go over that some more.
Okay. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin, this is Ryan in Washington.
Hello, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan.
Have you guys talked about the citizens' hearing yet?
Mm-hmm.
No, and I would love to.
I can plug it. Kevin, your audience should know that starting Monday there's going to be a hearing. Maybe Rich can expand on this more, but it's only $3 to watch the entire 5-day hearing. It's going to be in front of six former members of Congress in D.C. starting Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Press right. Club, and it's really cheap.
Well, yeah, actually, Ryan, thanks for mentioning this. Yeah. You're breaking up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there have been, you know, in the last decade and more, a number of, let's call them, press conference type events in the Washington, D.C. area. I mean, I think famously it's kicked off with Stephen Greer's big, big extravaganza back in 2001, and then a number of them run by Stephen Bassett, the ex-conference, at which I spoke at every single one of Stephen Bassett's ex-conferences over the years. Leslie Kahn and James Fox did a press conference in 2007. Robert Salas and Robert Hastings did one in, I believe, 2010. And all of these are important events, all right? But what Stephen Bassett is organizing with the citizen hearing for this week, starting in 2 days, or Monday, rather, 3 days from now, is something that this is beyond anything else, because it's a week-long event. So it's Monday through Friday, and every single day, we're going to have the former members of Congress who are going to be sort of like in attendance as like the judges, I guess, as it were. There will be panel discussions every single day. I'll be participating in six of those, by the way. And every evening there will be lectures, and I'm giving one of those lectures. A lot of other researchers, many leading researchers, are going to be at this. You know, from the U.S. and from around the world. There'll be a number of people talking about UFOs and the nuclear issue. Bob Salas of Malmstrom Air Force Base incident will be one of those. Some of the folks from the Rendlesham Forest UFO event are going to be at that panel as well. And much, much more is going to be involved here. So this is a week-long event that and it's going to be at the Washington Plaza Hotel, and it's right downtown Washington. This is really right in the middle, right in the heart of Washington, D.C. And if anyone is in the area nearby, I strongly would encourage them to go. Initially, I thought it was going to be free to the public, but it might as well be. It's incredibly cheap. And what you get
out of it. Well, do you get to ask these former members of Congress any questions?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I think so, yes. I mean, they're going to be just as visible as any attendee or any other speaker is going to be.
I would like to suggest a question. I'll put this bug in your ear, and you can think about it. Mr. Former Senator, why, when you were a senator, didn't you do this then?
Oh, well, you and I, and probably everyone listening, knows the answer to that question, Kevin, but I'll ask it anyway.
Okay, excellent. Ryan, do you have any further questions?
No, Kevin. Yeah, that would be nice to ask them. It's bipartisan, by the way. There's no party. It's both parties, Democrat and Republican. Mm-hmm. And people in the audience should, you can watch it all from your home, and you don't have to drive to D.C., and I just wish more people would be supporting us, and it's going to be like a something you see on C-SPAN where they have a hearing where, like, they have. I believe you're going to be seated, aren't you, Richard? Or
what? I'll be seated.
Are you guys going to be seated, and then it's going to be like?
I certainly hope so, because I'm doing six of these panels over the week, and I certainly don't want to be standing for them.
Well, anyways, I just thought I'd alert Kevin Smith's real audience about that.
Ryan,
thank you.
I don't think it's going to force disclosure, but at least somebody's doing something. And if we didn't have Stephen Bassett doing anything, then it would be a lot worse. At least somebody's trying, you know. So,
I could not agree more. And I've known Stephen for 13 years now, and I would say I'm very close to him in many ways. He can still make me crazy. I'll say this every time I talk to him, every time he calls me, his first words always are, "Richard, it is very important. I need you to do," and then fill in the blank. that's always what I get from Stephen. But it is very important.
Very important.
You've got to do.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. So, but here's the thing. You know, the man is truly carrying the world of disclosure on his shoulders. I mean, he's really doing it. And it's hard work, and everyone can try to criticize him all they want, and say, "Well, you know, you're not doing it right." Fine, well, let them do it. Let them try
absolutely.
To do it. I applaud what he's doing, and he's got a tremendous mm-hmm. amount of energy, and he just won't stop.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about a change in the 21st century, in the the way we think and the way we approach things.
Yeah,
and I've noticed this in my own dealings with the public at large, and that is the polarization is there, and those that hate you more, but there seems to be fewer of them willing to stand up and express it. I used to get hate mail all the time saying, "Well, why don't you do your show this way, and why don't you do your show that way?" No kidding. And my answer was, "Hey, you got a better idea? Get your own show and do it." You know, and that applies with Stephen Bassett. Like you said, you know, people that criticize, well, okay, then they should go do it.
I've had a number. I mean, over the years, believe me, I had more than enough arguments personally with Stephen over this strategy or that strategy. I mean, some of them got pretty heated. I'll just say that. But ultimately, I've always respected him, and I always will respect him.
What was one of the heated ones about?
Well, I'll tell you. There are a couple of them. One, I mean, really wasn't over UFOs. It was over 9/11 back in the early years after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I was, I don't know if I want to say I was the first UFO researcher, but I think I was the first like public UFO researcher to start talking about 9/11 as an inside job. If I wasn't the first, I was one of the first. And I felt like I was alone out there. That's the truth. And this was like in 03 where I was like starting to shoot my mouth off. And for me, it was important to discuss because, you know, keep in mind how much radicalized our world's become in the last decade. You know, when I wrote my first book, it came out in 2000. At that time, I mean, it's astonishing me to look back at this. That book, first volume of UFOs in a National Security State, was considered incredibly radical. And I look back on it now. I was just rereading some of it recently. I still like the book, but it seems very tame by my attitude today. It seems very tame, and not just from what I write, but from what a lot of people write.
Well, and that's evidence,
how far we've been going.
Yeah, that's evidence of this change we've been talking about. It was radical in the world in which it was first published.
Right. Well, anyway, by 03, it took. I was on to the 9/11 as a conspiracy theory by probably the middle of 02. It took me a little while. People would write to me immediately after 9/11, at least when theories started to fly, and they said, Richard, you have to look at 9/11. And for a little while, I just said, look, maybe you're right, maybe you're not. I really don't know. I don't have time for this. I'm looking at UFO matters. And back then, I was the new kid on the block as far as UFO research was concerned anyway. But I'm from New York City. My father worked at the World Trade Center. He had that day off, by the way. 9/11 was a very personal thing for me, as it was to many people. Anyway, I started looking into it, and I very quickly became convinced that whatever ultimately went down that day, it wasn't what we were officially being told, that that was a lie. And I started saying, and I'll say that to the day I die. I don't really care what anyone thinks at this point. I know what I believe. Anyway, I started talking about 9/11 at UFO conferences. And after the first time I did this, people would not let me stop talking. They literally they blew through lunch. I was a speaker right before lunch, and I went all through that. And it was an intensely emotional experience for everyone there. Anyway, at that conference, Stephen took me aside and he said, Richard,
you know what? We're going to have to find out what he said to you when we get back. A break is taking over. Hold that thought, and we will be back.
A million light years away from my home. A million light years away. For the mind.
easier to regulate. Cosmic sounds, transmissions clear and loud, the source I must investigate. Yeah.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Richard Dolan. And just a quick reminder, the Kevin Smith Show is 100% listener-supported. We don't sell advertising. And, you know, it's end of the month, it's crunch time, and I can tell you right now it's pretty crunchy. So, you know, if you got an extra buck, $2, $10, $15, $20, kick them our way if you want to keep us broadcasting, okay? It's very, very important. Richard, as we went away for break, you were telling us that you had been talking about 9/11 conspiracy, inside job kind of thing at UFO conferences, and then Steve Bassett came up to you at the close of one of the conferences or something, and he was speaking to you.
He was not happy. He was actually very, very displeased that I was going all 9/11 on the people at this poor conference. And he took me aside and he said, "Richard, now you've got to be very careful here. You are in danger of losing your credibility as a UFO researcher if you continue to talk about 9/11. And I got so mad. I said, "First of all, okay, as a UFO researcher, that means already that I have no credibility. So just forget that right off the bat." I did say that. And then secondly, my friend, the train is leaving the station, and don't miss it. Get on the train, because you're going to see. You mark my words. I said, history is going to bear me out on this. It's going to bear out any, all the people who are looking at this critically. And, you know, I was so adamant about it. I really was angry with him, I will say. I mean, not like furiously angry. I just was just annoyed. And I remembered photocopying a number of pages of, I think it was David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, which is a very fine book on this. And I just said, read this. I just sent him emails back then of all the JPEGs of the book. And I know he didn't read it for the longest time. But every time I would, because I dealt with Stephen all the time, especially in 03, 04, 05. And I was always grilling him. I was quizzing him. Did you read the book? And he's like, "I didn't get to it." I said, "Just read the damn book. I just sent you one chapter." Eventually, he did. He read something. He read something, because at some point, he said, "Well, you know, there are some pretty good arguments here, and I don't really know what I believe on that." But see, he's very smart in a way, because what he has to do is he knows what his goal is. His goal is not, he's not doing 9/11. Let other people worry about that. What he's trying to do as a public figure is he's focusing on the UFO disclosure issue, and more power to him. Let him do that. The other argument that I had with Stephen, and this is going to recoil out at me, but I don't even care anymore. This had to do over Alfred Weber, over one of the X conferences where Stephen invited Alfred to speak and gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. And it wasn't just me. Believe me, it wasn't just me. There were a number of people who were basically saying to Stephen, don't feed the man. You're making it worse. You're not making it better. This is not helpful for the disclosure movement to give this man a platform. But it was, you know, Stephen, again, was what we'd call the big tent sort of fellow. Let's bring everyone in who has something to contribute. That wasn't everyone else's attitude. And I'm not singling out Alfred. I know Alfred, and I'm on a personal basis. I like him. But I've had many, many problems with things that he has done over the years, be that as it may. So, you know, there are always points of contention that I could have. And then the other thing that I've just argued with Stephen, I don't really even argue it anymore, I don't care, but is over, like, when disclosure is going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, years ago, I mean, when I first got to know Stephen, he was saying, you know, it's going to happen. Like, he's like St. Paul the Apostle. Like, any minute, you know, God's going to come back any time now. People, get ready. That was Steve about disclosure. It's going to happen any year. And I just kept saying, I don't really think so. And I don't really see it happening. Mm-hmm. In the early Bush years, he explicitly, it was in 2002, he said to me that it's probably going to happen because it's in the Bush administration's interest to do it. And I said, no, I think the opposite. I think it's against their interest to do it.
But you know something? You used a good word in describing him and his work. You said he's focused. And he really is. Oh, yes. He really is. He's been a guest here a number of times. And I've met him personally. I've interviewed him on air in person. And I like him.
He's so easy to like, and not only that. I mean, I don't want people to get this idea that I'm criticizing my friend. He is my friend, and I would do just about anything for him. I've done many things for him already, but I admire so much about him. You know, when you watch him in a conference, first of all, he's one of the best public speakers you would ever see. When he's on, he is on, and there's nobody like him. I've been riveted by so many of his presentations, and they really are fascinating. He's done a lot of very good homework on all of them, and he's great off the cuff, and he's great when he's on mainstream media. He doesn't lose his cool. He's always on point. So I really think he gives, mm-hmm. you know, despite all of the, there are a number of very petty-minded, small-minded naysayers who really get on his case, but none of them would be anywhere nearly as effective as he is.
Well, and you're right. But back to the focus. I say this, you know, you brought up something about like 9/11, yeah. And I'm very, very, very cautious about having anything to do with that. And the reason is, it's not that I don't have an opinion about it. The reason is that when I started this show, I realized that a flashlight and a laser are both lights, but only one can cut steel, and it's the one that's focused. And so we stay focused on the strange and the unexplained. Now, I have done a couple of 911 shows where the person was bringing information that really was strange. Technology that we were discussing, and from that aspect it fit what we do here, but you know, Stephen has stayed focused like a laser on disclosure, and a laser, I can't say yeah. that it's guaranteed to cut steel, but I can guarantee you a flashlight won't.
Well, it's smart the way he does mm-hmm. it. A perfect example of what you're talking about, excuse me, was Greer's press conference in 2001, which in a lot of ways was a Herculean effort. I mean, it really was, you know, getting the numbers of witnesses that he got at the National Press Club, the largest room there, filling it, getting mainstream media. He got a tremendous amount of media watching. I mean, it was an incredible accomplishment, but it was diluted. And even I saw this at the time, and it was disappointing to me, which was that it wasn't simply a message about the reality of UFOs. It was a message about the intentions of these ETs. And it was also, it was diluted by a message that we needed to de-weaponize space, if you recall. Now, you could have an opinion one way or the other about space-based weapon systems, all right? But, you know, I think many people looking at that press conference could see that this is a problem politically. Why take on the Bush administration and Donald Rumsfeld just at the moment that they were absolutely weaponizing space? Why put this other albatross around your neck? You know, mm-hmm. the UFO issue is hard enough. It's hard enough to hit that ball out of the park. Then you're going to try to do another one? And then to claim that we shouldn't weaponize space because we're essentially alienating the extraterrestrials, who are good, in his opinion, I think this is a bridge too far, and I think it really seriously diluted and weakened the message.
And that's not
Bassett would never have done that.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that those are not valid points. It's just that it is a description of being not focused enough in the effort.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they were wrong necessarily. Certainly, I'm not a supporter of weaponized space. I don't know too many people who would be, as contractors would be. But right, it wasn't appropriate for that press conference. And this is where I think Stephen has a great strength.
I have a flash message here from Laszlo in Croatia. Laszlo says, is it true that the U.S. government is still covering UFOs until today?
Covering, as in tracking.
Cover up.
Yes. How do I answer that? Yes, the U.S. government still has a number of agencies that are explicitly mandated to track UFOs if they encounter them. North American Air Defense, NORAD, is one of them. NORAD is, by the way, impervious to Freedom of Information Act requests. So
yeah,
they don't really have to answer anything except as a courtesy if they feel like it.
Because they're not a U.S. government agency.
Well, it's kind of a meta agency because it's U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's American run. I think it's still run out of the, it's funded by the Department of Defense. I think it's a U.S. government agency. I wouldn't think that it isn't. But it goes beyond U.S. government.
Yeah.
It goes with Canadians.
Yeah. All right. So let's, I want to get back to something we sort of left. And we just have a few minutes left in the show. We've got about 3 minutes here until we take a break. And when we come back, we won't have but 7 or 8 minutes.
Okay.
And I want to get back to the consciousness
sure.
discussion. How do you, as a historian, approach the consciousness angle on this?
Well, it's very, I assume what you mean is how do I, as someone who tries to be a rational, responsible thinker who works in facts and documentation, deal with something as slippery and impossible to hold on to as consciousness.
Right. And let's exactly. add to that obviously a lot of the documentation that you as a historian could look to was written at a time and by people whose veracity is questionable.
I'm not sure what you... I'm not getting what you're saying in that.
Charlatans. That a lot of
the whole idea of like people making contact with ETs and so forth.
Yeah, and as a historian, you go back and you read as far back in history as you can find the writings about
this.
Well,
right. What I would say is simply this, because this is a big part of it. There are so many fakers who have littered the UFO field. Is like all this trash in the sidewalk, and you have to step around them. There's a lot of that. George Adamski, I believe, was one of these people. Now, Adamski to this day has got his defenders, but I'm not one of them. There are a number of other people who I do think basically made their living on lies. And some of them are nice people. That still doesn't mean they can't lie. Nice people do lie. There's a lesson in life that people want to learn. So here's the thing about consciousness. This is, I don't have this whole thing solved. And this book that I've written is not necessarily strictly history. There is history in it.
Okay.
It's quite a bit. But this is a new introduction to the UFO field. I mean, the final chapter deals with disclosure, as a matter of fact.
So it's not like the first book that you wrote.
No, this is a different kind of book altogether.
Okay.
This is, in my opinion, if someone wanted a new book on UFOs, like one book, I want it to be this book that I've just written. That is exactly my goal. And I'm in the final stages of it, and I believe that I've succeeded in what I've set out to do here, which is to write an excellent introduction to the entire topic, all of its complexity, and to do it in a fresh way. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, ultimately the answer is very, very carefully, Kevin. Consciousness is one of these things. I want to write about it, but I have to write about it carefully. So I think what I would say is that the contemporary science
we have step away, but we'll get your statement on the flip side of this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Richard Dolan, and we are on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. Just a few minutes left in tonight's show. Richard, you were making a statement about how to handle the very slippery information that is available to you as a researcher when it comes to consciousness. So you just started to say something, and the break took over.
Yeah. Well, just because we can, and we should, I think, open ourselves up to exploring the importance, the key importance of consciousness in the entire UFO phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Because really where it comes down to is it's our interaction with them, right? And however that transpires is something we need to explore. And if it's a mental kind of a connection, which it frequently is, then we need to understand that. That still does not give us license to lapse into a kind of what I would say an irresponsible subjectivity in which anyone can simply go out there and say, well, this is my truth that I learned. I downloaded this telepathically from my source and so on and so on. And I've heard this so many times. I lose count. I'm sure you have as well.
The way I approach it is if they downloaded it, it's for them. I don't have to believe it. I don't even have to know about it. It's for them.
Again, that's getting around the issue.
The issue is very much like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall without a bowl.
All right, I think we're on the same page here. I mean, all I'm saying is that claims like that are not what I would call responsible claims. If something like that happened to me, let's say I got a legitimate telepathic download from someplace, which, by the way, I have not. But let's say I did. I would at least, I would like to think, be aware enough to know that it would not be fair of me to have other people believe me. You know, it's still incumbent upon me to go about this in a responsible way with rules of evidence that are accessible to other people.
If you're going to involve other people in the story by giving them the information, yeah. But what I was getting at, if it happened to me,
right,
my attitude would be, that's for me.
We still have to be careful with this type of information. Mm-hmm. Because even though you may get what you think is a telepathic connection, that doesn't make it true. That doesn't make it honest. First of all, something could be trying to manipulate you. Mm-hmm. It could also be that you have misinterpreted something else that's going on. Maybe you're not getting a telepathic download from an extraterrestrial. Maybe you have something going on with your brain, or maybe you're getting consciousness from some other aspect of reality. Who knows? All I'm saying is that we want to be careful.
Well, I agree.
It's very slippery. We need to be cautious in forming our judgments.
And then there is this whole thing about dimensionality. It may not be extraterrestrial. It may be very terrestrial, the person that's talking to your mind, but in another dimension. And now, having said that, there are people that are going to say, oh, do you believe in that? No, I don't. And I have to say, I don't know about other dimensionality, but it's a possibility.
And contemporary physicists, they really don't either, except what you do hear them talking more and more about are other dimensions, especially guys like string theorists, mm-hmm. who, when they do the math of how they figure out what the universe is, they seem to come down to 11 dimensions, 10 of space and 1 of time, although now I understand it's even more than that. Who knows? does any of it make sense at all? I had an argument, or not an argument, but a discussion with one Harvard physicist a year ago who said, that's all a load of crap. He says all these people are string theorists are doing is just plugging in numbers. It's like medieval theologians arguing how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. He said these are meaningless arguments. Maybe he's right. I don't really know if he's right. But some of these string theorists, Michio Kaku, Brian Greene, a number of others, I think they seem like they got a pretty good handle on what they're talking about. And are there dimensions beyond our three of space and one of time? They think that there are.
Well, what I say is it's possible. Doesn't mean it's real, but it's possible.
Right. Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. And
we may never be able to know.
But I'm okay with that. You know, I know what I experience, and you know, I experience, you know, a three-dimensional world, which is actually four when you add time space. And you know, I experience that. I live in that, and I cannot live in some other dimension. So it's cool with me.
Our brains have their limitations. Our brains are, I mean, our minds are amazing things, but they're not omnipotent. They're not omniscient. And you know, you think of a fish in a fishbowl, really unable, I think, to conceive of the reality beyond its fishbowl. Probably, I'm just guessing here, right? Mm-hmm. And now there's us, and undoubtedly we have our own limitations as to things that we're actually not able to conceive. And if there is an intelligence that's looking at us the way that we look at fish in a fishbowl, we're really not going to be able to deal with them or to deal with their reality in any way that's mm-hmm. realistic. We'll never be able to.
You know, us in another dimension would be like a fish out of water.
Right.
We're not equipped. Exactly. All right. Do you have any websites that you would like to point us to?
Sure. Absolutely. The website that I've had for over a decade is called keyholepublishing.com. It's the name of the company. I mean, I don't just write books. I publish books. In fact, I'm publishing a bunch by other people now. But I will just mention this. This is an announcement that I'll be making much more in the near future. Keyhole Publishing is going to be, in the very near future, called Richard Dolan Press. And I'm changing it all. The website is going to be richarddolanpress.com in the near future. It isn't now, but it will be.
So now it's Keyhole Publishing.
Keyhole Publishing, which I've run for years. Earlier this year, I published a very excellent book by Canadian researcher Grant Cameron, co-authored with a gentleman named Scott Crane. And that book is still a very well-selling book on Amazon. It's called UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. I think it's an outstanding book. I'm publishing three books, not by myself, in the next 2 months. And then one book by myself, which we've just been talking about, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. One of the books that is coming out first is a book on the first book-length study of the triangle UFO phenomenon ever by a fellow named David Marler. And this is an outstanding book. I've read it all. I'm very proud to be publishing this book. It's called I'm drawing a complete blank now. It's the first book on triangle UFOs.
Okay.
And it'll be out in about probably in a month. And I was just chatting with David again earlier today. And it's called Estimate of the Situation, Triangular UFOs. That's the name of it. The Estimate of the Situation refers to a report in 1948.
All right, we got about 20 seconds.
Publishing a book, I think, by Dr. Bob Wood called Alien Viruses. Bob Wood is an amazing guy. And I just was chatting with my very good friend and former co-author, Bryce Zabel. And he's got a book he's just finished writing on JFK. And I think that we're very close to having an agreement to publishing that. And then my own book. All of this, I think, will be out by July, all of these four books.
Wow, full plate. All right, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And if you will, Richard, stay on the line with me for just a moment as I bring this one in for a close. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this evening. Richard Dolan, and it's always a pleasure when he is with us, and it's always mind-expanding and always, sometimes a little mind-bending, and all that stuff about dimensions is mind-bending. But you want to be sure and check out his website, keyholepublishing.com. And keep checking it, because that's where you're going to find out about the publication of his new book that we have been discussing tonight. Here in the 21st century, we do have to think about new things and in new ways. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You may call me whatever you wish to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.